Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next, a dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Welcome to What's Next. My name is Jay Moran. What's Next and its predecessor, Buffalo What's Next, has been around now for over 2 years here on WBFO, and I would like to think that one of the strengths of this particular program has been the variety of hosts that have been in this chair and have been able to bring their own perspectives, their own expertise, and their own charisma to these conversations. And with that, I think we've had lots of great conversations during this time because of that. One of those individuals is actually really one of our leading hosts, and that's Thomas O'Neill White. Thomas, great to have you.
Jay, thanks for the invite. It's great to be with you. Although, you know, I'm on the other side right now.
How does it feel?
it feels different, that's for sure, because usually I'm either, you know, in your seat or I'm in a seat right next to you.
Right.
That feels more natural. So I'm trying to get used to this setting on this side right now.
Hopefully it's a comfortable setting, and that's what's been able to produce all these conversations that we've had over these last two plus years. Thomas, though, in this particular case, we're not going to be hearing you hosting What's Next anymore. You're going to be departing a WBFO after how many years?
Seven, I believe. I was hired part-time, you know, as a board op on the weekends, on Sundays.
Wow.
In 2017, November of 2017, and then hired full-time in March of 2019.
Wow.
So it's been, and I also interned here. So
that's right. That's right. You're an intern as well. Thank you for going through the timeline. I've been here so long now. My dates have kind of merged together. And, you know, a lot of that, we'll get into some of the things that you've been involved in during this time here. But it is interesting to hear that, you know, you started as an intern, board op, reporter, and then host of What's Next. That's quite a rise.
It is. And, you know, if you would have asked me, you know, my first week as an intern, or told me that, hey, in 8 or 9 years, you're going to be doing all this wonderful stuff for WBFO, for Buffalo Toronto Public Media, I wouldn't have been able to wrap my head around it. It's been a whirlwind of learning. It's been, you know, my time here has been a time of growth, personally, professionally, in my relationships with the people I've had the pleasure of working with. So yeah, I mean, if you would have told me in 2014 that this is where you're gonna end up at, I wouldn't have believed you.
Can you reflect on just that sense of that you had when you first came here, and whether or not this really was for you?
I didn't know it was gonna be for me. I remember being put in a booth, and you know, them showing me like, okay, this is how you're gonna edit audio, and this is how you're gonna, you know, have it, being able to play it over our airwaves, and me just coming out of the booth being like, there's no way I'm going to be able to do this. No way. No way. And then, you know, you start getting the hang of it, and it's like, oh, okay, well, this is working. what's the next step? You know, script writing, all that stuff, you know, not coming into an interview well prepared, and also, you know, having the ability to change up if a situation goes sour. That's always something that was ingrained in me. But yeah, just coming out of the booth with no idea.
And yet here you are.
Yeah. Yes.
And most certainly, like you said, grown. You mentioned, of course, hosting What's Next. And there's some other times during your duration here at WBFO and reflect upon, but some of the conversations that you've had here in this studio, and I want to just kind of reflect on a few of those. I mean, you've talked to some really high octane people here in Buffalo. I'm thinking of people like India Walton,
mm-hmm.
Jillian Hainsworth, Will Green.
Yes.
What have you learned about the types of people who are in this community and have these advanced opinions and thoughts and energy to try to change this community? What have you seen? What have you learned?
I've learned that the people in, especially the East Side community of Buffalo, they're fighters. They're not going to give up on their community. They're not going to give up on the city of Buffalo. They're not going to give up on Western New York. As many times as people from outside of the community have counted them out, they're going to get back up. And I think my interviews with India and Jillian especially really... they really get to that feeling. Like they're not going to back down. They're and you know what I'm talking about.
Absolutely.
They are opinionated, and you know, and this is what I look like about What's Next. You're not just getting a 30-second, 45-second clip of something that a Will Green or a Jillian Hainsworth or a India Walton is saying. You're going to get half an hour to an hour. So they're able to break everything down for you to help you understand where they're coming from, where the community they represent is coming from. And I think that's the beauty of this program. The Tops on Jefferson, the scene of the tragedy, remains the only major grocery store on Buffalo's East Side. How does that sit with you?
It's been 2 years.
Yeah.
And I think that if our elected officials were serious about changing anything, then it would have happened by now. I can count on one hand the number of times I've been in that store in 2 years, and every time I go in there, I feel guilty. I feel a sense of guilt because I don't have to go there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
you've got options.
I don't frequent the store because I don't have to, right? Mm-hmm. I can get in my car, I can go to Wegmans, I can go to Whole Foods, I can order Instacart. But the people, many of the people who live in that neighborhood, that is their only source of food. And I know how painful it must be to be forced to still shop in that store and not have any other option.
I'm waiting for an executive at Tops or an executive at Wegmans or an executive at Whole Foods or even Aldi who will say, yeah, we wanna build a grocery store on Buffalo's East Side. How do we lean on these people, on these organizations, these corporations, to get them to do that?
That is a good point, and don't hold your breath. I think that one of the things that we've learned is that we can't depend on corporations to take care of us, right?
Mm-hmm.
The African Heritage Food Co-op was promised state funding to make renovations to open up an independently owned grocery store on the East Side, and we've not seen very much progress with that. I think that community-centered and community-oriented development
is the way to go. We can't depend on a corporation to come in and save our community because they're not invested. I think that we have enough talent and enough wherewithal to do it ourselves. What we lack is the resources, and that's always been.
Now, how would you define resilience?
I would define resilience as the ability to adjust to the new normal, the ability to create in spaces that are not designed for us to create, the ability to survive a system that is not designed for us to survive. I think Black people really embody resilience. You know, like if you are an African American, you are the direct descendant of a slave who refused to die in a world that didn't see them as a person. So I think we can really go down a really deep path when we talk about resilience, especially as it pertains to Black people. But in simple terms, it's just the ability to keep going.
Mm-hmm. And it's, how would you apply the word resilience to Buffalo's Black community on the East Side? Same way?
Yes, in part. I would still define it the same way.
Yeah.
But I would definitely, I'm always careful not to praise resilience too much, because I think sometimes we subconsciously or unconsciously normalize the things that we are surviving for the sake of our ability to survive it. For example, after May 14th, I came on this program and a lot of other programs and really pushed back on the Buffalo Strong theme that we were seeing happen literally May 15th. People started saying, we're Buffalo Strong, we're Buffalo Strong. And I'm like, but if we're being honest about all of this, what just happened is a sign of a weakness. We are exposed in this area because you can close one grocery store and stop thousands of people from being able to access food. It's a weakness because you can Google, where do all the people live in Buffalo, and easily see that 14208 has the most densely populated Black population outside of New York City. Like, these are weak spots. So instead of praising our strength, we need to really focus our energy towards the issues, the things that are causing us to have to be resilient, because they're not normal.
Another, I thought was one of your really great conversations that you had, was about the state of Black journalism. We had Ejaz Jaseel, who's the head of the local society of Black journalists, in here, and it was a roundtable discussion. And it was now what I think, for probably reflecting maybe a little over a year ago, year and a half ago. But what about what maybe you gathered from that conversation about the state of Black journalism, and maybe where it might be going, where it is right now, of course, and then, you know, maybe what needs to happen moving forward?
Well, the state of Black journalism, you know, when I'm out and about, you know, at press conferences, and I see another African-American reporter out, you know, I try to talk to them, but it seems like it's few and far between.
Right.
And, you know, just recently, I think the editor of the Buffalo News was let go. She was African American. So just with that, it doesn't seem like the state of Black journalism is moving forward, at least in a way that, you know, I would be happy about. Obviously, within this newsroom, good things are happening. I mean, you can walk into our newsroom and it's Black, white, it's brown. There's a lot of representation within our newsroom. So, I mean, I'm happy that we are very much carrying that flag. But as a whole in Western New York, you know, we could always be better.
Right.
We could always be better. I don't want to say, oh, we're this is terrible, but we could always be better. State of Black journalists in Buffalo, what's your take on that?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think there are so many different things to look at. While I am pleased to see that there are a lot more Black faces in our newsrooms, in reporter capacities, producers, photographers. I still feel like we could be doing better. It shouldn't just be maybe one or two people per station that you're familiar with who are people of color. And we do have an issue with turnover. I think that's our biggest problem. And that's for a number of reasons. I mean, Buffalo, we have 210 designated market areas in the nation, right? And of course, both of you know what that is because you're journalists. But for those who don't know, you know, it's pretty much areas with that are ranked by households that have the most televisions. And out of 210, Buffalo's 54th. So we're not at the bottom, but we're not the most desirable market per se. And in the aspect of Black journalists, there are places within the top 10 that are just culturally better for African Americans, like Atlanta, for example. It's like, I can go here and not only thrive professionally, but thrive personally. Now, I was born and raised in Buffalo. I'm a native all 30 years of my life, and I love my city, love it deeply. But a part of loving anything or anyone is accountability. And I'm not gonna pretend that we haven't always had an issue with segregation and racism, because we have. This is not always the most welcoming place for Black people, whether they were born and raised here or whether they come here. So a lot of our talent we get here, unfortunately, for a number of reasons, don't stay very long. So we have to do things to change that.
Well stated. Thomas O'Neill White with us here on What's Next, host of What's Next, and he'll be departing WBFO very soon. So we thought we'd get him in here for some reflections and on his time here. I know how much I've learned about this topic is really from your work about suspensions in the Buffalo School District. You have become very connected with a group of people who have pushed very hard to get that issue into the forefront. One that I'll just admit for my own ignorance, and there's been a lot of that since we started this show about things I've learned, but just how detrimental suspensions can be, and the effort of people, again, who want to change the reality.
Right. And I think that story, then the continuation of the suspension story, I wouldn't say it's like near and dear to me, but as someone who was suspended a lot, you know, it's kind of a natural thing. But yeah, like, you know, just like I was talking about with India and Jillian, like this is a group that, you know, and I'll shout out Jessica Bauer Walker, Khadija Hussein, Danielle Grismala, who are not going to back down. They're not going to back down. They are all about uplifting student voices. They say, you know, this is what we're working on, but here are students impacted by suspensions. Here are students who, you know, are impacted by this, by the commissary and the issues surrounding whether or not there's going to be a new commissary or not. So, you know, we can be kind of experts to some degree on the challenges, but you got to hear it from the horse's mouth. So I've had a lot of fun getting to know some of these students. But you know, it's a difficult situation that they're in. Suspensions. Obviously, I think I got to know you through your work dealing with suspensions. I kind of want to break this down into two parts, just talking about the superintendent's claim of a decrease of more than 500 suspensions due in part to restorative practices. But Jessica, you would say these numbers are incorrect and the restorative practices are being used incorrectly?
I wouldn't say that necessarily. I would say that we need to put these numbers in context. So the assertion is that the suspension numbers have gone down based on the district data. They have gone down. The long-term suspensions have not gone down as much as short-term suspensions. We also hear a lot about what we would call informal or honestly illegal suspensions, where students are asked to go home for a day and calm down, or sometimes a couple days. We also know that there's a lot of in-school suspensions, and we've asked for data on that and we have not been able to get them. And while the students are in school, They're not getting regular classroom learning. The students cannot teach themselves certain subject areas. They're in a room all day long, right? So I'm sure our students could speak to some of the practices that they're seeing, but the numbers have not gone down that significantly. We're still seeing thousands of students suspended, and those disparities, if you look at the data, you know, the disproportionality, what we would call the difference between a white child who is of a higher socioeconomic status who doesn't have a disability, their chance of getting suspended is so much less likely. And we see this in the research too, and we've done our research around looking at ways to reduce and eliminate suspensions. Other districts that have done that, they see an increase in disproportionality. So while numbers may be going down overall, the number of Black students that are getting suspended, students with disability, low-income students, students who don't speak English as a first language, can actually go up. So back to that equity piece, I think we really need to do a deep dive and say, are we truly doing better? One of the things we've asked for is, what are the total days of suspension? Because a long-term suspension can range anywhere from 6 days to the entire school year, basically. And so I think we just need to do a little bit of digging deeper and just start implementing some real changes around, you know, let's eliminate K-3 suspension. Like, why would a kindergartner be suspended? And these students can talk about some of their experiences with suspension for themselves and other students around, you know, what they perceive to be district practices, and are we doing restorative practices?
And again, like I said, it's some really remarkable conversations, and some that, again, has helped, at least for me, and hopefully for other people. I'm wondering about that. Some of these conversations that you've had here, and like you said, you're out at press conferences and things like that. Do you get the sense that the conversations that are going on inside this room are starting to, I don't want to say change, because I think change is something that's got a long way to go. I think we can really agree with that. But at least maybe generating that, like, look, we can't hide from this. We can't hide from these. We might want to keep these issues distant. I'm talking about politicians, officials, things like that. That maybe there's some vibration that's coming out of this that's getting out there to the power structure.
Yeah, I think so. And I've been told, and I've seen, you know, people kind of promoting our show in certain episodes that we have done, because it's in alignment with what they're doing, you know, out in the real world. So I think these conversations are having an impact on what is going on, you know, politically within the school board, you know, farming wise, all over. So we are doing a good. We're doing a community good.
Nice, very nice. Now, another one of your, again, some of your memorable work came outside this community when you guys went to Charleston.
Yes,
that again, some lessons learned there for sure. The idea was, of course, to reflect on what happened in Charleston. I think a decade ago, and of course what happened here in Buffalo on May 14th of 2022. Again, reflect back if you can, some of the conversations that you had, and maybe both the maybe positive things that could happen and maybe some of the things that aren't happening.
Yeah, Charleston and North Charleston, it's an interesting place. A lot of history there. Good and bad, obviously. When you talk about Charleston, South Carolina, I interviewed a advocate and a reporter for a public radio station down in South Carolina. But my conversation with the advocate, and believe he was on and off politician.
Right.
He was talking about how, you know, in the aftermath, in the direct aftermath of the shooting, how, you know, everyone's talking about how can we be better? What can we do? And, you know, as the years gone on, there was just less and less talk about, you know, communities coming together, making, you know, uplifting the Black community, or finding out what were the challenges in the Black community and dealing with this racism that is, you know, a little more in your face, you know, below the Mason-Dixon line than it is up here. And then with Victoria Hansen, the reporter from the South Carolina public radio station, it was reporter to reporter, so it was right. A different kind of conversation. And I remember, you know, the one of the last things she told me was, don't just talk about 514 on the anniversary or leading up to 514. Talk about it all the time, or at least talk about the issues that spawned 514, or the issues that were spotlighted in the aftermath of 514. And we continue to do that. I'm happy to say that we continue to do that here on What's Next.
Peyton Gendron, who was the murderer of the Tops Market,
yep.
He was able to target Buffalo's Black community specifically because of Buffalo's segregated history. Does Charleston suffer from the same thing, from the same problem, Charleston and North Charleston?
Absolutely. We have, here in especially over the last few years, we've seen the rise of militia groups here in South Carolina, the white nationalists, and there are three geographical strongholds for them. One of them is right here in the Lowcountry, the other is in the Midlands, and the other is in the Upstate. And these groups are on the rise, and they are they have violent tendencies. As a matter of fact, their tendencies to be more violent have been heightened over the last few years. It seems like they have permission now to do that. Right here locally, every Sunday morning since Mother Emanuel, there's a group of Confederate flaggers, and they go down to White Point Gardens, which is right at the tip of the peninsula. It's a beautiful space out there. And they go to that space every Sunday morning, and they stay there for about 4 hours. They have these huge Confederate flags and everything. And
yeah, I heard about this recently.
Yeah, they, and we-
They march?
No, they stay in that one spot. But there are some ordinances that are being violated by them being there and doing with the size of their banners and things like that. But they are not stopped, and you know, we've had counter protests, especially after George Floyd's murder. We had counter protests there, and the law enforcement in the city of Charleston demonized the George Floyd supporters, the anti-Confederate flag protesters, as opposed to, you know, telling them, okay, we need to shut this down, really, or something.
What can we as reporters in Buffalo learn from the reporting that has been done in Charleston in the wake of the shooting?
Don't stop. Don't just do a story when there's an anniversary. Oh, it's the 1 year anniversary. Oh, it's the 2 year anniversary. Oh, it's the 10 year anniversary. Oh, let's do it at 5. Let's do it at 10. Let's do it at 15. Don't just call those families at anniversary time.
Mm-hmm.
Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop. Don't stop sharing their stories. Don't stop checking on them. Don't stop seeing what has changed or not changed in your city. Don't stop checking and asking questions. We still don't have a hate crime law in this state. 8 years after one of the most horrendous hate crimes. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. And we keep asking. And we keep asking, and we keep pointing out there isn't one. So I would say, as reporters, don't forget about the story. And there'll be another shooting, sadly. There'll be something else that happens.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, and so don't forget this one.
I was going to say, maybe before you leave, post it up on a big sign and put it right up here in the studio, just to keep that memory alive.
We should do that. Let's talk to promotions about that.
Absolutely.
I do want to point out one interview that I had with Garnell Whitfield, and it was not in this studio. It was over in B studio, mm-hmm. because this studio is being used, and it was just him and I almost face to face, and we talked for a little over an hour. And obviously Garnell Whitfield lost his mother, Ruth Whitfield, in 514. I was on the verge of tears several times, just listening to Mr. Whitfield speak. It was very powerful. It was very I think it was one of the first times that I did an hour long, had an hour long interview, and you know, I had so few questions, and I just let him talk, and I let him let the emotion come to him, and just let him speak, and we hugged afterwards, and I'll remember it to this day, to the day I die.
So you can remember then that sensation. I'm sure that you felt that it's beyond butterflies when you're sitting in the interviewer's seat, especially when the conversation gets that heavy.
Yeah.
I'll go reflect back though to a conversation we had back during the wintertime. You and I were the hosts. We sat right here, and sitting in that seat was Dr. Ibram X. Kendi.
Oh.
And I can still feel the sensation in my stomach when we had this incredible speaker, controversial individual here in our studios. How do you reflect on that conversation?
Well, I remember, you know, walking in and he stood up, I shook his hand, and I was just immediately like, you know, I know who he is. I've read some of his work, but it's just like, oh, this guy's really, really smart. And it kind of, not like he is like, he'll tell you he's really smart. It's almost like it's emanating from him. And that doesn't happen a lot.
Right.
But, you know, right off the bat, you know, sitting down after shaking his hand, I'm just like, oh, it's going to be a real good conversation, no matter what, no matter what. And yes, I think you'd agree that, you know, we were just kind of blown away with the interview.
Yeah, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. One of the more memorable ones for sure of many memorable ones that we've had here.
What do you want a child to get out of reading your adaptation? A child of any color, any creed, any race?
Well, I want them to start to begin to understand slavery. And I'm hoping that the child comes out of this book becoming even more curious, wanting to learn more about every sort of step in his journey, wanting to learn more about traditional African communities where people were taken from and enslaved, wanting to learn more about the march to the coast that Kodjo had to endure, wanting to learn more about the Barracoon, where Kodjo was held on the coast, wanting to learn more about the Middle Passage, you know, across the ocean, and slavery and plantation slavery, and, you know, the Civil War and Jim Crow, wanting to learn more about each aspect of Kodjo's story.
We'll get away from what's next for just a moment and reflect back on another part of your time here that doesn't get a lot of play, but it's something I'll always remember. And that, of course, is the Saturday night when you were out covering the Black Lives Matter protests in Niagara Square.
Yes.
And you, along with others, were pepper sprayed by Buffalo police.
Right, yes. They must have thought I was a protester. I had my lanyard on, but maybe they didn't see that. I think I got a little too close to the action. And yeah, I got a blast of pepper spray. It was a real mess down there. It was a real mess. But you know, being the person that I am, you know, I wanted to get good shots of what was happening, and you know, I was Icarus going a little too close to the sun on that day, and I got a blast. And fortunately, there was people around who, you know, everyone was getting pepper sprayed, it seemed. And they were giving people, you know, washing them down with milk, because water isn't going to do the trick. So like I got a little bit of that, and I stumbled back here to the studio and started working. And that was
that's right. They never forget to
started writing scripts. And then I was also interviewed live.
Right.
You know, after that incident, and I was still, gosh, I listened back to it and I was still kind of shocked. So I don't think the interview came off very well. And I'm also like not used to being interviewed.
Right, of course not. Yes.
But at the same time, you know, I was still kind of in some sort of shock that it happened. But, you know, it's a learning experience.
I had a professor at Buffalo State who reflected on his time at the University of Buffalo when he was just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time during student protests. And, you know, he got tear gassed. And he said, that's when I went from being just an observer to being an activist, that it changed his perspective on things. I'm just wondering if that sensation, if there was a different feel for how policing is done for you.
I would say no, because I have, you know, in a previous life, I was doing those marches. I was, you know, being, you know, a little active in these BLM and other organizations, or at least doing these marches, marching for gay rights, marching for women's rights, marching for immigration rights, things of that nature. So I don't think, you know, my experience, you know, in May of 2020 or the George Floyd protest didn't really change my opinion of policing. I think I've done a bit of research into policing and understanding the how and the why. So did it reaffirm some things? Maybe so, but at the same time, the protest was a bit out of control.
Okay. All right, fair enough. I appreciate the perspective on that, mm-hmm. for sure. Let's get for a moment to maybe something that was another interview that was not necessarily serious. Kente Claus,
my guy. Yes, and I hope that he is able to come back this holiday season. Kente Claus just does a lot of good, you know, from Toronto to Buffalo to the Caribbean. Kente Claus is really putting in the work for young black and brown boys and girls, you know, delivering gifts, and also, you know, centering blackness or in the holiday, during the holiday season. I think that's his greatest gift. And he also does, you know, his alter ego, he is also doing great things, you know, in the Buffalo area, in Southern Ontario, and throughout the Caribbean. So a big shout out to Kente Claus for all he does. And he knows who I'm talking about.
Thomas O'Neill White, you know, as you depart here, one of the things I also reflect upon with you is, I'm not sure if there was any other NBA fans in our newsroom until you showed up. And well, that has since changed, which is quite refreshing. So we have a lot of conversation about it. So I'm not going to see you next winter or next spring to know who's going to take the title this year. Is it going to be the Wizards?
It's not going to be the Wizards. You know, they are young. And the next few years are all about growth and development.
So you're hopeful about that?
Yeah. I hope they're the worst team next year and they get the number one pick. I just want to see the young guys develop and in 4 or 5 years be a real playoff contender. This year, you know, I still think the Celtics are probably the favorites. I don't think they've really lost anyone except outside of Al Horford, who actually, you know, with his retirement, people are gonna see how much Al Horford meant to the Celtics this season. But I still think they're gonna be really good. Out of the West, it seems like, I mean, you've got Dallas, you've got Minnesota, you've got Oklahoma City,
Denver,
right? They wanna get back. It's more of a toss up in the West. I like Minnesota and OKC. I think those are the top two teams in the West. And it's funny. You know, you talk to me about basketball. When I was a kid, I knew I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be a sports writer. I wanted to write about, back then it was the Washington Bullets. But that, you know, that dream has kind of morphed into where I'm at right now. Kind of funny thing. I wanted to be Tony Kornheiser. I wanted to be Mike Wilbon. Those are the guys that I looked up to.
So I guess the question is, as you depart, you're happy with the place that you're in and the growth that you've had. Like you said, it's morphed. That interest in sports, that idea that you're going to be a sports writer, and now you've become a journalist and moving on to other things as well. You feel like you feel good about that.
I feel good about that, and I want to, you know, shameless plug, I want to thank Buffalo Toronto Public Media. I want to thank WBFO. I want to thank you, Jay Moran, for helping me grow. And, you know, when we have interns in here, I say, you know, there's a lot to learn here. There's a lot to learn from the technical aspect of producing to, you know, writing, but it's all going to be helpful to you. And, you know, if you can succeed here, you can succeed anywhere. And I was telling Jamal Harris that earlier this week, and he's off to a great start. And I look at him and I'm like, I was that.
Right.
I was that 8 years ago. And I'm looking forward to see where he is at in 2 years, in 4 years, in 8 years. So I think, yes, if you're a journalism major, a comms major, come to WBFO, see what we're all about.
And then a final question. So again, I'm going to ask you to reflect back to 8 years ago, and best you remember, was I as grumpy 8 years ago as I am now?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a good question.
Maybe for your
grumpy? Oh, you're not grumpy now, not around me.
Okay.
Maybe you were back then.
Very nice. Now, Thomas, I have to ask you now to pick up the headphones that were set out for you here, because we're going to wrap up our conversation with a little bit of some dialogue here that you can listen back to. So,
all right.
Michael Loss, our producer, go right ahead.
Hey, Thomas, it's been an absolute pleasure working on What's Next with you. You've been an incredible host to work with, and it's been an honor to see your network and learn about the issues that you want to bring to our platform. And I'll make sure that we'll continue to talk about those issues and that your legacy here on What's Next will always remain on the airwaves.
I just wanted to take some time to say thank you, Thomas. Best wishes on what's next in your career, you know, because during your time here, you know, you were so impactful, not only uplifting the stories and voices from a community that isn't always at the top of every newscast for every station, you know, you were really the one that pushed those stories out to the general public to highlight a lot of the things happening in the community that, you know, might not have been brought to light if you weren't here doing the work you do. Then on top of that, not only are you serving the community well, but, you know, you're serving your fellow reporters here well, constantly making other people's stories better just by your presence, by your advice, by adding context to things that, you know, we might not have thought of at first, and just pushing the boundaries of what good journalism can be. So impactful to this newsroom. And I think your legacy, of course, will live on here, you know, through the likes of everyone who's been able to work with you. And, you know, even future reporters and staff members here, I think, will be well served by having just that wealth of knowledge in your stories that come across, the news stories, all of the editions of What's Next that you've hosted and the people that you've brought together from all parts of the community that, you know, drove conversations that, you know, might not have happened had it not been for What's Next and your leadership in really seeking out all those voices, all those views, all those important stories in the community. So once again, Thomas, thank you so much for everything you've done for WBFO, for the reporters here, for those in the community, and for our listeners all around the region. Thank you.
Thomas, thank you for being such a presence in the newsroom, a real calming voice, but also one of wit and humor. Sitting next to you was just such a joy. I always felt like I had somebody to talk sports or Lord of the Rings or just history with. The number of times where I felt like I was like, I don't want to be a pester, you know, I don't want to be a pest, but at the same time, I just want to hear what Thomas has to say on this topic. And you were always always keen and willing to play into whatever questions I had for you. So I always appreciated that. And just in terms of work things, always you were so helpful with any questions that I had, whether that was on how to ask a certain question for an interview or best practices as far as cutting audio and maybe what your preferences were when you were looking for sources and just the story gathering process. Just so helpful on all levels, and it's going to be a it's going to be melancholic goodbye, and we'll definitely miss you.
Thomas O'Neill White, I feel like I've known you since Oprah Winfrey was born. When I first got hired, I was a content associate, and we were doing something about like an employee spotlight, and you were my first interview when you were here. You were my first person that I interviewed, talking about how you love sports and ESPN and Bomani Jones and all that. So that was my first introduction to you, and now year and a half being in the newsroom, just to see, just throughout the years being here, seeing how you work, see how you go about things, the professionalism, and just how you execute being a journalist in Buffalo. And also when we go out, everyone knows you. It's like you're Barry Bonds going out in San Francisco. Everybody knows you, which shows how much you've made to this community and how much you've done for this community and how much you've done for this newsroom. And it's going to be a lot of big shoes to fill, but I think that where you're going next is great, and we wish you nothing but the best of luck. I wish you nothing but the best in the future. Not even the best of luck, because you don't even need luck. You've got everything that you need. So again, thank you for just your professionalism and just you, who you are as a human being. And we appreciate that so much. I appreciate that so much. So I wish you the best, and hopefully see you around so that I can be one of those people that also knows you in the street.
T-O-W, Thomas O'Neill White. He's meant so much to me throughout my short time in the WBFO newsroom. And Thomas, I'm really glad to see that the luck that you have garnered through your hard work, through your dedication to the craft, has paid off, and it will continue to pay off. I'm really excited to see what this world has in store for you. The time that we've spent together, while limited and brief, has been full of knowledge. Your perspective that you bring has certainly transformed the way that I view covering sports on an NPR station for an NPR audience. You've helped me think about things in a different way. Our conversations covering all sports, from college football to NFL football to even WNBA basketball, I've really enjoyed each conversation we've had, and I look forward to continuing those conversations. As you move locations, I certainly will remain here for you in any capacity that you need. So with that, Thomas, this is Jack saying I bid you adieu.
It's really bittersweet to hear that Thomas O'Neill White is leaving us, and not just because he's a talented reporter, but genuinely one of the kindest, most respectful, and caring coworkers I've gotten to work with. I started at WBFO as an intern 5 years ago this spring, and I remember one of my favorite projects I worked on was with Thomas. And not because it was an important story, it's because Thomas never questioned if I knew what I was doing. He just trusted that I did and was supportive when there was something I didn't know. Thomas has always stood out as someone who treats everyone he meets with an equal level of respect. Since becoming the station's disability reporter, Thomas has always been the other reporter in the room I really look up to, since we both cover beats that are personally close to us and our identities. Seeing how Thomas has always had a clear picture of what his storytelling is and isn't afraid to honor his own experiences in the process of news gathering is something I've admired and learned from. I think covering a community you are a part of, being with your community on their best and worst days, is a privilege and a really difficult thing at the same time. And the way Thomas has always handled his work with grace and honesty is something I won't forget. Our newsroom is truly going to have a massive piece missing when he's not here. Thomas not only cares so deeply about his work, but about his coworkers. He's the kind of person who will notice when you're having a bad day and take the time to ask. Thomas, I just want to thank you for everything you've taught me. Thank you for being someone I can look up to in the newsroom. And I know I speak for everyone when I say we are going to miss you, but we will always be cheering you on in everything you do.
Thomas O'Neill White, thank you. Thank you for being you. Most people are going to just go through the list of things to thank you for, but man, just thank you for being you. I remember my first day at BTPM. At WBFO, I remember sitting there doing my introduction, and I remember stating that I had a wrestling podcast, and it was at that moment we became brothers for life. Because when you find someone that enjoys sports entertainment, enjoys wrestling as much as you do, there is like this forever bond that will always connect the two, and that's what we have. I will miss our wrestling conversations, even though we still will have them, but I will miss it on a day-to-day basis. I will miss our sports conversations. I will miss our hip-hop conversations. I will miss your realness, because you kept it real with everybody. This is the curtain call. This is not a farewell, though. This is just, I'll see you on the other side.
Thomas O'Neill White, well, where do we begin? You are a rare thing, a sound, solid reporter who always makes it look so easy. Your ability to cultivate and keep sources means that you always have an ear to the ground and know what's happening out there in the world and on your beat. And as a host of What's Next, you can be relied upon to get the most out of any guest. And then to top it all off, everything you do is always with a cool and calm demeanor. On a personal note, as my desk neighbour, I will especially miss you. We've always been able to have a laugh and a joke together to brighten the day. I would wish you luck for your future endeavours, Thomas, but I know that you don't need it. You're going to be just fine. Thanks for everything.
We are bidding farewell to our dear colleague, Thomas O'Neill White. After an incredible journey with WBFO, Thomas, you are embarking on a new chapter in your career, taking a fantastic opportunity. I cannot tell you how proud I am of you and how much good wishes I send along with you on this new path. You are an invaluable member to this team. Your expertise, your sense of humor, and just your presence in the newsroom has made a huge impact, not only for me, but everyone that you work with and everyone here at BTPM. I honestly want to thank you for myself and for Western New Yorkers. You are a friend, and just like a friend would, you tell us what we need to know. Sometimes it's not the greatest news, but it's always to make us better. And I can't thank you enough for that. On a completely personal note, you and I are the last people standing. I remember when I first started here, you were my friend. You taught me the ropes. You helped me along when I was absolutely stuck on my stories and couldn't edit because I never could edit well. But you were right there with me, and I appreciate that, and I consider us friends for life because of it. We are incredibly sad to see you go, but we are excited and proud to say that this is where you have roots, and no matter what, you will always be a member of the WBFO news team and the BTPM family. Thank you.
And as we wrap up this special episode of What's Next, I'd like to join my colleagues in thanking Thomas O'Neill White for all that he has contributed to WBFO throughout his tenure. We mentioned it earlier in the program, but your coverage of the police protests at Niagara Square stands out among the most important work conducted by this news operation during my many years here. It is very much in your personality to downplay what happened, but being pepper sprayed by police for simply performing your duty as a journalist reporting on the facts highlights the real importance of the job and its inherent dangers. Additionally, your departure from What's Next leaves a huge void that will be difficult to fill. You worked to develop important contacts, tackled some of the city's most important issues, and brought a uniquely informed viewpoint to the program. Thank you again, Thomas O'Neill White. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.